Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. In episode 3, season 1, I spoke with Yosuke Kawasaki, a wonderful violinist and the concertmaster of the National Art Center Orchestra Canada. During this conversation, we addressed many things, and he spoke about his experiences studying with Dorothy DeLay, the inspiration he found in many of his peers growing up, and we talked about his role as a concertmaster and his advice for young colleagues entering the profession. Please share and follow this podcast to be informed of all the new episodes coming out with a fascinating range of musicians.
Hi, welcome to episode 3 of Conversations with Leah. And my guest today is none other than the concertmaster of the orchestra I play in, Yosuke Kawasaki. Welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me.
This is so great you agreed to talk with me. Yeah. I have so many questions. There's so many things I want to cover.
Okay.
I'll start with, this year has been weird. We're talking during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of violinistic go-to you've had as part of a routine that just kind of keeps you centered?
The first thing that I looked for when this whole thing started a year ago, I think we all quickly realized how much we put an importance on routine, and we just didn't have any anymore. So in our family, I have two little kids. The older one was in first grade at the time. So we revolved our schedule around her all of a sudden and her needs. And then I realized that one student in particular that I teach privately, she also needed a routine as well. And it was a win-win situation. So I just met with her every day at 10 in the morning and did like a half an hour of teaching or anything really. But I found that to really provide that center, you know, that you're talking about. From there, I motivated myself to keep in shape, you know, practice and learn repertoire that I haven't learned yet.
As a repertoire you've been working on that's been really interesting for you?
I would say it was more out of necessity. It really centered around teaching a lot. Mm-hmm. There were so many concertos that I haven't really learned during my time at school that, you know, students play as standard concertos now these days, like Korngold. It wasn't as standard when I was growing up. So, studying that but other pieces that I haven't studied well. So both of the Prokofiev concertos, really. There were some Schubert Fantasy. You play that.
Yeah.
I thought that was great for like just kind of basic technique work and just playing in tune and clean.
Mm-hmm.
It was great work. Yeah. Oh, that was the other thing. I realized that when I sing vocally, I don't sing in tune at all.
I heard you say this in another conversation we were having. The thing is, we have to realize, is we're not trained singers. It's really hard to sing in tune. It's just technique, I think. It's not your ear, right?
Right.
But have you tried whistling? It's much easier to whistle in tune.
Jessica mentioned that. Jessica's my wife. She's also a violinist in the orchestra. She mentioned that I whistle better than I sing. But it was shocking to me because I thought that I sang in tune, you know? So that has something to do with my ears, I'm sure. And it was because my daughter was singing something for her school exactly a year ago. She was recording something. And the parents were encouraged to sing with them. And so I was singing an octave lower, trying to provide this carpet of bass for her to sing on. And, you know, of course, she wanted to play back immediately. And so we started listening to it together. And that's when I first noticed that I horribly out of tune. I started getting paranoid, you know, that everything that I've been practicing, that maybe perhaps I'm not hearing it quite in tune. And there was a period there for several months where I started really doubting my intonation. So,
did you find you recorded yourself more at that time?
Yeah, I did. A lot. Yeah, pretty revealing. I've noticed certain tendencies, mm-hmm. Especially in first position when we play. You know,
it's less comfortable, right? Like first position. You'd think it would be more, but...
Yeah, it's comfortable. And I think that comfort also is very deceiving because you stop listening and relying to muscle memory and, you know. Mm-hmm. And so for me, in particular, my C's and F's in first positions, they're always high.
Actually, what I was saying is it's less comfortable, I think. Well, because you have to stretch further and your hand's more open. Like third position to me is like super comfortable. You know, it's middle of the...
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I've also experimented with, you know, using shoulder rests and not. Mm-hmm. And now I don't use one. But, you know, my technique really changed when I decided not to use it. So I don't think I properly adjusted at the time. I mean, this was 10 years ago now. But, you know, because I was on my own already. No one was teaching me how mm-hmm. to do it. So, you know, I kind of figured it out. How comfortable I am, but yeah, maybe there were things that someone else could have pointed out 10 years ago that would have helped.
You know, I remember my teacher saying at a certain point, one day you're going to have to teach yourself. And right. It's so true, right? That's the big transition. Yeah. And you studied at Juilliard, you studied with many, many famous teachers. I'm curious, what is it like? You were 10 and you started in Juilliard pre-college, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like? What kind of experience do kids have in a program like that?
That's a good question. I mean, it's hard to recall everything. It's just flashes of things mm-hmm. here and there. I mean, for me, my father is currently a teacher and a violin teacher. He's teaching at Juilliard. A lot of my friends, I suppose, were his students, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to describe. I didn't have a sense that I was doing something different. It was always part of my life. So Saturdays were fun for me. It was a day that I got to see a lot of my friends that shared the same interests as me. Of course, I had friends at school during the week, but yeah, there wasn't a special connection there, I suppose. So
did you have like orchestra and were there chamber music opportunities right. when you were young? I'm curious about all that
time. Yeah, yeah. The day started off with orchestra. There was chamber music, but that was optional, I believe, and I only started doing that a little later. But it was orchestra, and then we had classes like ear training classes, theory. What else do we have? Oh, of course, individual lessons and master classes.
Were the master classes fairly often, and would they bring in outside people?
At the time, we didn't have access to outside people. At least I wasn't aware of it. Every studio was pretty siloed off. Mm-hmm. So we had master classes within the studio. So my teachers were Hyo Kang, my primary teacher, and Dorothy DeLay.
I've heard stories with her that she was always running late and people would wait in the hallway for hours for their lessons. Is this true?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there are funny stories on why that happened too. There was a summer, as she always taught in Aspen Music Festival mm-hmm. in the summers. And there was one summer I forget how this came to be, but she took in, I guess. She was a motherly figure, you know, and she took in 4 students. This was, I guess, in the 80s, late something, yeah, 80s. And I'm not going to mention who they were, but I think she had, like, late nights, like, you know, like, not partying with them, but, you know, really just having a good time, like, living with her students and sharing a space and talking about music, I'm sure, and I'm sure there were some card games going on as well. But, and ever since then, that's the story. I don't know if it's true, but she sort of adopted this kind of late night ritual, and it's just hard for her to get up, I guess. You know, so, the day just it didn't start until about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. We were all just kind of waiting, and I've been at her house when in the morning sometimes when she asks for students to just come and have an extra lesson here and there, and you know, for some students it's, you know, it's because they're preparing for a competition or something like that, and for me it was always like, yeah, I need to whip you into shape again, so you need to come over. And you know, so I would be at her house in the mornings, and even then there was no sense of time, you know, there was no sense of like, okay, I arrive at 10 and I end at 11, right? It was always like, okay, I arrive early, of course, you know, try to be there on time. And then we're just sitting there, you know, she's having coffee and she's offering me something to eat, and then she'll get a call from, you know, various like competitions all over the world and, you know, schools, and you know, she was a political figure in our world. So I think, you know, she used those mornings just to kind of, yeah, make phone calls. And they didn't have emails back then, so.
Would she have you practicing your scales while she was doing that, or you were just?
No, I would just be sitting there. Yeah, she said, you know, sometimes she said, you know, I could go practice, but most of the time I was just sitting there.
When she coached you on repertoire, and maybe other teachers too, was there a big focus on how to do things technically, or just kind of assuming that you knew and more about the music?
Yeah, she always had a technique class, and she had a brilliant way of doing it. She had her older students teach the younger students, and she knew how to pick the older students too. It was always the ones that needed the technique themselves, and so I was also teaching technique class to the younger kids when I got older, but. Yeah, and so we just concentrated on basics, so scales, arpeggios, shifting exercises, all the Sevicic exercises, and not really etudes, you know, really basics, and, you know, maybe vibrato exercises, things like this.
You have a really beautiful vibrato. I'm curious, do you remember someone teaching it to you, or what kind of exercises do you like to give students?
Yeah. It's such a personal thing, and everyone vibrates, you know, differently, right? Some people vibrate from the arm, some from the wrist, finger combination. No one ever really taught me my vibrato, I suppose. I always just try to emulate sounds that I heard. So, you know, growing up, my father was a huge fan of Pincus Zukerman. So I just heard a lot of Pincus Zukerman in my house, you know, like.
Yeah. And then on stage, he was our music director for almost 20 years, right?
Right. When I first came, I thought, oh.
I was going to ask you about, so you've been a concertmaster, not just here, but many orchestras. Mm-hmm. Your whole orchestral career, I believe, was being concertmaster, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were festivals where we rotated within the section. Yeah.
But it. So did you aspire to be a concertmaster when you were younger?
No, not really. I was... I was in a studio with Dorothy DeLay, Hyo Kan, and, you know, these were teachers that taught Gil Shaham, Sarah Chang, Midori. There was just a lot of violin virtuosos in her studio. And so I think the younger generation especially just sort of aspired to, well, Perlman, Isaac Perlman being another one. Mm-hmm. So we all aspired to be soloists, you know. And being that young, when I was 10, for example, we didn't have any clue what the politics were in classical music or how difficult it would be to actually have a solo career, mm-hmm. you know. So, but that's what we all strive for. So in our practicing, like the routines that we had, Dorothy DeLay always had a 5-hour routine. So start with basics. I mean, this is in general, but hour of basics, hour of scales, hour of etudes, hour of Bach, and then an hour of concerto. And if you have a short piece, you know, or sonatas, you have to kind of add on to those hours. So, yeah, I mean, I never really practiced 5 hours a day, but definitely 3, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you first started filling the role of concertmaster, a lot of people don't understand, why are you late for every concert? You know, you know what I mean? Like, concertmaster comes out alone, takes their bow.
Right.
But it's, people have said to me, oh, they lead your section. They don't realize what an incredible responsibility it is. And did you have surprises when you first started acting in that role?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the first time I might have sat in that chair. I don't think I was even aware of what the responsibilities were when I was when I first started doing it. I just thought, I mean, the one advice that I always followed was my father's advice, which was, you know, just try to do the best that I can in whatever I'm doing. So whether that's playing solo or playing at a wedding or, you know, playing in the back of the section of the orchestra too, right? Like, it's just do the best that you can. So I think that was initially what I was trying to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you're doing it, I suppose you start to pick up on a lot of things. I mean, I started playing in orchestra when I was, well, 10 in pre-college, but at Aspen Music Festival, they have different orchestras there as well. It's a 9-week festival. And the first audition I took, I was 12 or 13. And they put me in the Chamber Symphony Orchestra, which performs every week. And it was new repertoire every week. It's kind of like what we do professionally. And I was just thrown into this situation. And I was sitting last stand, second violins. And the youngest in the orchestra, and my stand partner was, I don't know, 16 or 17 year old Korean violin. Her name was Angela An. She plays in a piano trio. And she just like showed me the ropes, right? Like, okay, first of all, you have to have a pencil. I keep forgetting my pencil, you know? And then she said, okay, you have to turn the pages. You know, so like I started turning the pages. It's just like, no, that's too early. That's too late, you know? And so you just learn these sort of etiquettes as you go. So I had great experience when I was already 12 or 13 and just kind of looking from the back to what's happening in front of you. It's a fantastic perspective. Like, and you see the concertmaster. The concertmaster that I played under for all those years in Aspen was David Perry. He's out in Wisconsin, I think. Fantastic violinist and leader as well. behind. So he was a student of Dorothy DeLay. Right behind him sat Robert Chen. He's a concertmaster of Chicago right now. And so he was also studying with Dorothy DeLay. And it's just seeing the two of them there. And then I think there was also Nick Ennett, who was a longtime concertmaster of the Metropolitan Orchestra. So I was able to just observe and kind of pick up the antics or whatever it is, the gestures of these three violinists for 6 or 7 years. I just watched them, you know, from various places in the orchestra.
Mm-hmm. One thing I find interesting in orchestra, people may not realize the conductor has to beat quite a bit ahead of where the music sounds. Mm-hmm. So they have this orchestra in their head that's ahead of what they're hearing. And then the concertmaster, which you do so well, you have to show it just early enough before you play. You can't be late to your own, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's all this sort of anticipation happening
mm-hmm.
for everyone to play together.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about that or does it just come naturally?
I've been thinking about it more recently. And, you know, because we haven't been playing, you know, certain tendencies that every orchestra has, it seems to get exaggerated as the pandemic goes on, mm-hmm. to me, anyway. And, you know, we're all kind of living in our own world, right? Even when we're practicing, our own time, our own intonation, you know, like it's all just, you know, kind of circling around you. And I think we just get used to it more and more as we do it. And so when we're not getting together and playing all the time, it's hard to kind of come together again with that sort of timing that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I mean, conductors always have to beat ahead. For me recently, maybe it's you know, the closer you sit, the easier it is to react. Of course, that's true. I just find that, us trying to anticipate what the conductor is doing is also part of the job,
mm-hmm.
right? Not waiting for the beat. So my thoughts on that are, I don't know, hard to talk about right now without having done it in so long.
So I was actually on the selection committee when you were hired. And right. It was a long process. I think it was 5 years searching yeah. for a concertmaster. And I really remember the first time I heard you play, and I was just really blown away by the color in your playing. Just incredibly beautiful contrast of tonal color and really inventive musical expression. So I've always really admired that about you. And yeah. when I see your fingering choices, sometimes you'll just be way up in the D string on some solo that no one else would maybe choose that. It's really risky, but you really go for color.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you just, is it conscious with you that you keep pushing the boundaries that way or just always been part of your playing?
Yeah, it is something that I think about all the time. I prefer playing slower music. I like slow movements of everything.
So you mentioned, you know, you're coaching university students, and I know you coach young professionals entering the profession. You hear a lot of auditions, a lot of mock auditions. Do you have advice you'd give people preparing auditions?
I don't know.
What's often lacking, do you find? Why aren't people getting the job?
That's a hard question. Because it's not as general as it seems.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, every playing is so different, you know, and we all hear what's lacking, I guess. So, you know, my advice is that, you know, try to be honest with yourself, I suppose. Like, try to really be aware of your strengths and weaknesses. My teacher, Dorothy DeLay, was so great at paying compliments. You know, she always started off the lesson, no matter how bad I played or how bad anyone played, with a compliment. You know, she would always say, "Honey, you have the most beautiful sound." And then she'll go off and just start to, you know, dissect everything that was wrong with the play. But I think that's super important to really know what it is that you do well. And if you can put that forward, if you can bring that to the foreground, you know, despite the weaknesses that you may have, then I think, you know, we as, you know, panel members, and, you know, we can hear some of that confidence as well, mm-hmm. in people's playings. And and then of course, from excerpt to excerpt, you know, we've been doing a lot of audition training in the orchestra as well for participants and students, and you know, bringing out the differences of every excerpt and showing the panel your versatility is a great way to, I think, advance in auditions, you know. But every orchestra is different. I remember auditioning for Chicago once, and the only comment I got was I missed one note. So, you know, there was another comment. My vibrato was too wide. Hmm. Yeah.
So you came from Japan. So you're like kind of bicultural, would you say? Like you.
I was born in the States, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
My and parents then you moved are back. Japanese. Yeah. Okay. But you've worked quite a bit in Japan. You're fluent in Japanese, would you say? Mm-hmm. So would you say there's a slightly different culture in the orchestras there compared to
North
America?
Yes, very, 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 yeah. Yeah, culturally, it's a different place. Yeah, there's a real sense of hierarchy there, mm-hmm. Based on experience, based on age, especially. Mm-hmm. And good things and bad things about that. But their whole modeling of an orchestra and the etiquette, the politics, that sort of thing, it's sort of modeled after European orchestras more, like, mm-hmm. especially German orchestras. So when I first started playing in orchestras there, it was different. I mean, in the end, you know, we're all working towards the same goal of you know, bringing together a program, you mm-hmm. know, but yeah, the process was it's much more organized, that's all. Like there's a sense of, because of that sense of hierarchy, everyone is it's not a criticism of how we do things here at all.
Yeah.
It's just different.
So you play a lot of chamber music.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think about the fact that when, of course, we need to focus in on our own playing with any group, but you need to have this incredibly wide focus so mm-hmm. that you're listening across and all that. And an orchestra, it's really amplified, right? So you don't have time to study every score before every rehearsal for every piece. So are there sort of go-tos, like things you know to listen for to sort of keep track of where to fit in? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I usually just try to keep a ear out on the bass line. So not just the double basses, but cellos. And, and a timpani.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just the furthest people from me that I just try to keep always an antenna up for, and then I hope that everything in the middle will sort of converge together. But yeah.
So I know things are just getting going again. You're running a couple of chamber music festivals as artistic director, I believe.
One in Japan. It's called the AFNIS Summer Music Festival,
mm-hmm.
and it has a 30-year history, but it moves around a lot. And for the next 4 years, I think we're going to be in a city called Nagaoka. It's very close to the Japan Sea. But it's a chamber music festival designed for just orchestral musicians, though. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's great. The participants are all members of different professional Japanese orchestras, and we invite, I guess, principal players from orchestras from abroad. So there's a concertmaster from Gewandhaus Orchestra that comes there. Last year we had Storgards there as well. That was great. Yeah, every year, slightly different members, and we all. It started off as sort of more of a coaching situation, because it was designed in the beginning. I guess with the idea of how, you know, like how do we improve rural orchestras in Japan, professional mm-hmm. orchestras? But it's come such a long way that most players of any orchestra in Japan, but also across the world, you know, like it's the level so much higher. And I just mean facility wise, playing wise. Mm-hmm. And so these days it's really just, you know, a collegial feeling, you know, making chamber music and a cultural exchange through music, I guess you could call it.
That's really great to hear.
Yeah, it's fun.
Do you think you'll have any kind of online component going forward or just
live? Yeah, we're doing one this summer.
Okay.
So unfortunately, the invited musicians, so from abroad, we can't go to Japan. Mm-hmm. So the groups that are being assembled in Japan are also not from different orchestras. They're from the same orchestras. Mm-hmm. And they're being sort of paired with invited musicians from abroad. But, you know, ultimately, when we have situations where, you know, one person is listening to a group, play, it becomes sort of a coaching, right? It just, you can't avoid that dynamic. So I try to make it more collegial by inviting two musicians mm-hmm. to listen to the same group from the same orchestra. So this summer, Rachel Mercer and I from our orchestra, we're going to be working together with a group from Hiroshima Symphony Orchestra. I thought, you know, just to have just even two different perspectives of the same performance or same playing, you know, that's going on, will kind of spark that kind of, you know, group discussions more. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're going to tackle it that way. It will culminate to a live performance in Nagaoka, just played by the Japanese ensembles. And yeah, we're doing a children's concert as well, as we do every summer. And that's also interesting this year, because we're using this new technology by a Japanese company called Fujitsu. It's like a little device that looks like, it's called Ontena, but it's for the hearing impaired. Mm-hmm. And it vibrates and lights up different colors and things like this. And you can clip onto your hair or to your ear or hat or whatever, shirt too, I suppose. And so we're trying to come up with a programming around that.
That's really great.
Yeah, it's fun.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me this morning. It's been really
goes by really quickly. I'm surprised my daughter hasn't kind of come up yet.
Okay. Yeah. So, goodbye.
Bye.
Season 1 of this podcast had 20 episodes, and Season 2 continues with a really interesting mix of musicians talking about their lives and careers with perspectives on overcoming challenges, finding inspiration and connection through a life so enriched with music. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about each new episode.